Where'd you find this?
Oh, Craig's on mushrooms tonight.
He's suspended for 3 games for this kind of behavior.
That's right.
Before we get started, Shane, I want to ask you, what's a sweatier hobby, Magic the Gathering or fantasy football?
I think they both bring the worst kind of nerd out, but like hygienically and like social skills, I definitely say it's Magic the Gathering.
Okay.
Okay. toilet now.
What a way to start episode 93. We are almost done, y'all. We are almost done with our team recaps. We're almost ready for the season. We got to watch some preseason last night. We saw our boys, Dorian Thompson-Robertson and Izzy Abanacanda look all right.
Scored
a touchdown.
I will say, though, I was very upset after like the first 3 minutes when I had to look at Aaron Rodgers and Deshaun Watson for every single segment. I was like, right. Can we talk about anybody else on these teams? For the love of God, I get it. They're the media like points, but like, can I just watch Sauce Gardner play Call of Duty? I don't care about right. this old man and this rapist. I don't give a shit.
Yep. It was an interesting Hall of Fame game. Josh Jacobs didn't play. I know. So we've got a bunch of fun stuff today. We've got the Carolina Panthers. We've got the Minnesota Vikings. And we've got
the Jacksonville Jaguars.
Yes.
2024 Super Bowl champion.
Jacksonville Jaguars. Jaguar.
Jaguar watch.
We're on Jag watch over here.
Ryan, so just to get ahead of the news and plant our flags, who wins the Super Bowl MVP with the Jacksonville Jaguars?
Okay. Let's see. Well, I've said that the Jaguars will make it to the Super Bowl. I did not necessarily say that they would win.
Whoa.
But in this scenario, they're going to win. Let's see who's going to be the MVP. It's got to be Trevor Lawrence.
Yeah. Even though I'm not going to lie to you, if Jacksonville won the Super Bowl this season, I could see the MVP being like a DB with 2 interceptions and 1 return for a touchdown or something
that. Maybe.
A very Patriots finish.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's hop in. Let's do our 93s. Ryan, you got a shorty for us?
Sure. Let's start with famous number 3. Actually, we don't talk a lot about players that are younger than us. Let's talk about Lawrence Guy, born in 1990.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Well, younger than some of us.
Yeah.
That's true.
He's older than me. Hey, to be fair, Tony's guy last week was the same age as me. So.
Okay. So Lawrence Guy, born March 17th, 1990, famous defensive end, played for the Packers, the Colts, the Ravens, the Chargers. He was all around. So, you know, he got to win the Super Bowl with the Patriots. That was in, what was it, 2017 season?
Sure.
He came to that team that year, signed a $20 million contract. He recorded 58 tackles and a sack. So in the AFC Championship game against the Jaguars, Guy had 6 tackles and a sack to help the Patriots reach the Super Bowl. And then in the Super Bowl, Guy recorded 6 tackles, but the Patriots lost to the Philadelphia Eagles.
Ooh. He got Philly specialed.
Dude, that team was so good. I did research this week on Frank Reich. That team was great.
That Philly team?
Yeah. Yeah. So I was wrong. The Super Bowl was not that year. They won it the following year, when the Patriots defeated the LA Rams 13-3.
Worst Super Bowl of all time.
Yeah.
Isn't it so funny how like most teams only get to the Super Bowl one time and then the Patriots like, yeah, they just made it next year and they just won it. Right. Whatever. No big deal.
That's all right, guys. We'll get them next year. But other than that, he's just a mediocre defensive end, played for a bunch of teams. And he does a lot of charity work. But last year, Guy was the Patriots nominee for the Walter Payton Man of the Year Award, and he and his wife operate the Lawrence Guy Family Foundation.
I think, like, if he won, they'd have to call it the Guy of the Year Award, right?
Yeah. Another reason why I picked this guy is he had a lot of learning disabilities when he was younger. He was in special ed classes, and he had ADD, dyslexia, and I don't know, Tony, because you're a teacher, you might know what this is. Dyscalculia? I have no idea what that is.
Can you spell it for me?
D-Y-S-C-A-L-C-U-L-I-A.
No clue.
It's a disorder that affects a person's ability to understand number-based information and math. So,
right.
Okay.
So, sure.
I think I have that looking at data graphs. Oh my God.
So for someone to have all three of those disorders growing up and developing, it's kind of interesting that he was able to do well in the NFL, learn plays that well and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's very complicated.
Well, something that I've learned in my years as an educator is that if someone's brain is what we would consider below par in one aspect of learning, it's probably really good at a different type of learning.
Yeah.
And so, like, however it is that he chooses to visualize football makes sense.
Yeah.
He made it work for him. I got 4 college degrees, and, like, outside of changing my tire, everything else involved with a car gives me, like, nightmares. You know? Like, it's just different types of intelligence.
That in cars nowadays, everything's so electronic. It's like you almost have to go to the dealer to fix anything.
I appreciate you making that excuse for me. All right, Shane, who do you got?
I got a number. It's not a guy. It's a metaphor. My 93 is the death and rebirth of Dennis Rodman.
Yes, Rodzilla.
Yes.
The worm. So I'll be honest up front. Rodman is someone who's always intrigued me as a kid because in my lifetime, at least, I've always known him as being the person who has walked to the beat of his own drum. He's the dude with the weird hair. He's the guy who married himself. He's the dude who went to North Korea, right? I never knew like previous era, like what was the Detroit Pistons? The Bad Boys? Is that
Bad Boys. Yep.
Yeah. I never knew that arc until I watched the Michael Jordan documentary. So 92 going 93 wasn't the best year for Rodman as the Pistons were falling apart. His coach and mentor, who he basically viewed as his father, Chuck Daly, resigned from the Pistons. Rodman felt that he was isolated and betrayed as he had really bad intimacy and connection issues. If you have the time, please watch the 30 for 30 doc. It's like $1.50 on YouTube. It's a fantastic documentary.
And oh, yeah. And if you can, read Bad As I Want to Be by Dennis Rodman.
I think that came out. It came out like immediately after this event happened.
Okay.
So in 92, Rodman ended up divorcing his then wife, Annie Banks, who was also the mother of his daughter. Rodman basically admitted that he lost his purpose and the love of playing basketball as it was his entire identity. He was very much a person who really had no connection with life. I mean, the documentary goes into that, but like he was homeless till he was like 24 years old. And then
right.
He was just playing ball and they found him and signed him to something, and then he went to a small town. Anyways,
well, he didn't make the league until he was like 25 or 26 or something like that, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he stated that he had no foundation, nothing solid, and no one to confide in during this time. So at 6 a.m. in February 1993, he went to the palace where he had a gun rack and a gun in his vehicle, and he contemplated suicide. There's a few things that culminated in Rodman deciding not to take his own life. So the first is that he fell asleep listening to Pearl Jam.
Sorry.
Which I was like, I hate grunge music. I think it's one of the most obnoxious genres ever, but like I'm glad Pearl Jam exists solely because Dennis Rodman is still alive to this day.
Sure.
So he was actually listening to the song called Even Flow, which he took as a personal message to himself, where he had the culmination of understanding that this moment and the way he was feeling wasn't about basketball. It was about him feeling betrayed and wanting to be loved so much in life. And he realized that the person he was presenting to the public wasn't actually who he was. So he woke up, the police got him out of the car with the vehicle. They're still worried that he was going to do something. So they had to be very cautious, but luckily the cops didn't do what they normally do and shoot black men.
Yes.
So late NBA broadcaster can be credited in stopping Rodman's attempt as he saw him at the strip club the night before and tracked him down and told him that committing suicide was a stupid and selfish decision. So it's tough love for sure. So Rodman went on to thank Craig. I don't remember who his name is. One of the most famous.
Craig Sager.
Yes, he went on to thank Craig Sager in a tweet after he died of like, hey, if you didn't do that for me, I wouldn't be alive. So there's layers to this engagement.
Craig Sager's a local boy. We love Craig Sager in Illinois.
And he also admitted, too, that if the NBA had the resources that it had now in regards to mental health, he wouldn't have reached this point in his life to push him to this kind of decision. So after this happened, Rodman demanded a trade and would be dealt to the Spurs, even though he had like 2 years on his contract. So this is where the arc of Rodman would become popularized as Rodzilla. So before the first game as a Spur, he shaved his hair and dyed it blonde after he watched the movie Demolition Man.
Let's go.
Yes. Which as today too is the anniversary of the clip, or the date in the movie is the clip.
Yep. When Simon Phoenix was unthawed from cryo jail.
Yep.
So, and then he'd go on to dye different colors like red, purple, blue, and cheetah. He actually would dye the AIDS red ribbon in his hair.
Yeah, the ribbon. Yep.
To promote for LGBTQ, because he ended up hanging out at gay bars and hanging out with a lot of drag personalities, because he just felt like they were very confident in themselves, and that's what he should do.
He's also somewhat of a drag personality.
Yes.
And you'll be amazed, because the way HIV and the AIDS crisis interplays with sports is actually part of my 93. So,
oh, nice. And we don't ever talk about this before, just to pull back the curtains. We're just synchronized.
Yep.
While he was a new man, he was still a bad boy based on his Detroit persona, and would go on to headbutt Stacey King and John Stockton during the 93 and 94 season, refusing to leave the game after being ejected. He'd go on to have a fling with Madonna. He'd actually find kinship with Jack Haley, as Haley was kind of viewed as his handler, but he was also someone he could confide in. Because Haley never acted weird or surprised or judged Rodman because he'd visit gay bars, which at the time is a very homophobic and AIDS crisis-centric time period in human history.
Do you know that? So Jack Haley was with him in Chicago as well. And there was one moment in the finals when the Bulls played the Sonics in the finals, that was all Rodman. He got in everybody's heads. He guarded Sean Kemp. Like, he was all over the place. And he kept getting their goons ejected from the game. And I remember at one point, one of their guys got ejected. Frank Brickhouse was his name. And he's walking away. And he calls Jack Haley a fucking babysitter. And Jack Haley played in one game that year for the Bulls. They had already gone 71-10. And it was their last game of the season. And he got some run for like 5 minutes. So they called him Haley's Comet because he played once every 75 games.
So I'm not going to say Rodman is someone to be idolized, someone to be looked up to, as his personal life section on Wikipedia is so much longer than his basketball history on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Even as a Hall of Fame player. And he's also someone who amazes me as a Hall of Fame player, because like, if you look at his shooting percentages, the dude didn't shoot. He just played defense and rebounded. And he just hustled. That's all
he did. He averaged like, I don't know, something ridiculous, like over 20 rebounds a game or something.
And his points was like 7 points a game.
Well, like, you know, he actually like was a legend for the amount of tape he watched. He's a tape watching legend. Mm-hmm. Like when he would go to a team or they would get a new shooter, he would watch hours of their shots so he could get an idea of where the spin would cause any missed shots to go towards, so he could be in better position.
Yeah. Again, you said like someone who never was like formally educated, but someone who understood their own intelligence and used that in a way to be successful.
Yep.
So no one can really deny Dennis Rodman is probably the most intriguing player in NBA history. And maybe, I know we cover a lot of cool guys on this podcast, but Dennis Rodman is definitely one of the most interesting people I've ever taken the time to listen to or study or learn anything from.
Yeah, right. So, he's our ambassador to North Korea.
That's true. So please take care of yourself and use the resources around you if you're having a manic episode. So about a rebirth positive. So let's just take care of ourselves and each other.
Get your mental health in check.
Did you know they used to airbrush the tattoos off of Dennis Rodman for cards?
Really?
Yep. Narc shit, if you ask me.
It's just all right. A barbed wire symbol. It's fine.
Right? Okay, so I've got a barn burner for you guys today.
Okay.
Today, we are not going to talk about a player, but we are going to talk about a team. One of the most interesting groupings of humans I've ever seen before. This is the 1993 Cursed Houston Oilers.
Okay.
So the best place to start is at the end of 1992, where the Warren Moon and Webster Slaughter, Houston Oilers lost to Steve Tasker and the Buffalo Bills in the greatest playoff collapse in NFL history. You guys remember that? talked about it.
What is, was it as bad as the Chargers versus the Jags last year?
It was worse.
Oh shit. I gotta watch that.
It was worse. So it's actually known to Oilers fans as the choke.
That's terrible. It's two words.
Yeah, it's a poor choice. It should be like choke gate. So this team had always, like, the way the roster was set up, this team had always flirted with success and they always made the postseason, but they never even made it to the AFC Championship. Owner Bud Adams knew the 93 team was the best chance they had to make a deep playoff run, since the next year was when the salary cap was going to be instituted. And they were like, well, we're fucked next year, so we might as well push the chips in now. They decided to make a move on defense. They bring in Buddy Ryan of 1985 Chicago Bears fame to coach the defense. Jack Pardee's the head coach. Kevin Gilbride is the OC. And Buddy Ryan is the defensive coordinator. Now, Kevin Gilbride ran the run and shoot. All right. And if you're not familiar with the run and shoot, just a real TLDR, it's four wide receivers. It's pass, 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 quick play, quick play, quick play. And when it works, you score 40 points a game. But
sure.
But when it doesn't work, you have the ball for 35 seconds and then you punt the ball back to the other team. Yes. So you've got a high risk, high reward offense and a high risk, high reward defense with the 46. We got Warren Moon, future prominent sexual harasser and CFL and NFL Hall of Famer. He's 37, and the Oilers made it clear that they were ready to pass the torch if he didn't win right away. They made their backup quarterback, Cody Carlson, the highest paid backup quarterback in the NFL.
Nice.
Buddy Ryan brings in one of his guys, former Bear and Washington linebacker Wilbur Marshall, to help run his defense. The Oilers and Houston agree to a trade. Houston backs out of the deal. Wilbur Marshall sues Houston, and the league forces the deal to go through.
Oh, we're learning, dude. Just take it to court. You'll always win.
Take it to court. Seven players on this team held out into training camp.
Wow.
We're off to a great start. So week one, Houston gets fucking wiped by the Saints. Just absolutely annihilated. Defensive coordinator Buddy Ryan is already in the media talking shit about the offensive game plan. Wide receiver Ernest Givens goes to the media to essentially tell Ryan to fuck off. And Ryan's response is, I don't know who Ernest Givens is.
That's the best retort to anybody ever.
Yeah, I don't know you. Who the fuck is that? Even though he'd made the Pro Bowl last year, Ryan's response was, I don't know who that is. So Houston wins next week. They go 1-1. And then the week after that, Moon throws four interceptions against the Chargers and gets benched. Houston loses that game, and then they lose to the Rams, even though they were 10.5-point favorites going into that Rams game.
Oh, my God.
So in 93, the league experimented with two bye weeks, something that I think we would all be in favor of.
Yes.
And so Houston's early bye week, they're at 1-3. They get their first bye. They go to Buffalo and get their shit kicked in again. They go 1-4. Now, remember, like, this is a team with Super Bowl aspirations. Moon gets benched. Cody Carlson gets the next start and gets hurt. Moon comes back in and gets the win. So now they're 2-4. The week after that, there's drama with right tackle David Williams, who didn't show up for the game, instead choosing to stay back in Houston to witness the birth of his first child. The Houston Oilers and owner Bud Adams fined him $111,000 for misplaced priorities.
Bro, I'd quit the team.
Wow.
Yeah, national media went wild with this story. They called it Babygate. So it's like Chokegate. All right. Houston goes on a fucking tear, though. They beat Cincy, Seattle, Bengals, Browns, Houston, Falcons, Cleveland again. And all of a sudden, Houston is 9-4. All right. This win against Cleveland is December 12th. So December 13th, reserve offensive lineman and special teamer Jeff Alm was out celebrating his soon-to-be-ended time on injured reserve with his childhood best friend. At 2:45 a.m. while driving home, his Cadillac crashes into the guardrail on the freeway, and his best friend, who wasn't wearing his seatbelt, Sean Lynch, was ejected from the car, fell off the edge of the road 30 feet to his death.
Oh, my God.
The offensive lineman calls 911 to report the accident and then commits suicide on the side of the road.
Oh, my God.
And the team is rocked. You know what I mean? Like, the team is dismayed. And so the head coach is trying to keep everyone together. Houston ends up clinching the division in his honor in a very emotional win the next week. They beat the 49ers again, so they're on a 10-game win streak despite all of this insanity. However, in spite of this opportunity to, like, you know, work together through common tragedy,
yeah,
would it shock you that these old-ass white dudes would get really upset with each other still?
No.
No.
Yeah. Buddy Ryan...
We love to cannibalize.
Right? So, Buddy Ryan is always calling blitzes in practice. All right? Fights at practice were always happening because of the aggressiveness coming from the coaches because they hated each other. Buddy Ryan's still going on the media to talk shit about the run and shoot offense at the time. And to be honest, you guys, he has a point. The team lost multiple defensive starters to season-ending injuries on drives that did not need to happen, but happened since the run and shoot refused to kill clock at the end of the first half. Multiple times this happened.
Wow.
So let me give you a perfect example. In the last game of the season, they've already got playoffs locked up, whatever. Houston's at home against the Jets. They're up 14-0, 37 seconds left before halftime, and they have the ball at the 33. First play, goes deep, incomplete. Second down, Warren Moon drops back to pass and is strip sacked. So now the defense, who just made a stop, has to go back out there with their backs to the wall. So Buddy Ryan goes ballistic, and this 59-year-old man walks towards the offensive coordinator screaming and throws a punch. So the 59-year-old defensive coordinator of a soon-to-be 12-win team just took a swing at the offensive coordinator on the sideline. You could see this. I mean, it's a really shitty punch because he's an old-ass man, but, like, he swung on him, dude. Sounds insane, but then something even crazier is apparently in the press box, wide receivers coach and quality control coach Frank Bush also got into a fistfight at the same fucking time.
Nice.
And had to be split up by the assistant general manager.
Dude, damn, inside the job. They timed that shit.
The assistant general manager was there?
Yeah. So the coaches had to be escorted out of the building separately by police from each other. They spend the first round bye talking shit about each other to the media. Buddy Ryan saying the offensive coordinator should be an insurance salesman instead of a coach. So the Oilers go into the playoffs as the 2 seed. They have 8 Pro Bowlers. And in their first game, they have a rematch with Kansas City. But unlike the first time they met in the regular season, Joe Montana was playing that week. So if Houston wins, they go back to Buffalo for a choke gate rematch. Oilers were 7-point favorites, jump out to a 10-point lead, and end up blowing it. In the second half, Buddy Ryan stopped calling blitzes, the first time he's ever done that. Warren Moon was sacked 9 times.
Oh my God.
And fumbled 5 times.
Jeez.
Yeah. And they lost. So the team had, after this, the team had 27 free agents. All right. And they traded Warren Moon to Minnesota. Buddy Ryan left to go be the head coach of the Cardinals and brought Wilbur Marshall with him. Pardee and Gilbride would be fired midway through the next season when the team would end up 2-14. Now, since the season has ended, the legacy of the 1993 Houston Oilers lives on. In 2013, it came out that 2 of the players were openly gay. So, 1993, in fucking Texas, in the midst of the HIV crisis, the fact that the entire locker room has unanimously in the media agreed that everyone was like, yeah, they're good football players. What the fuck do I care about who they have sex with?
Right.
Like, it's for 1993 Texas, that's still a pretty progressive attitude to have.
That's still progressive now.
Yeah, no shit, right?
True.
Unfortunately. So, with the high pick they got for being so bad in 1994, the Oilers would draft Steve McNair. And the interim coach after Pardee got fired was Jeff Fisher, who would go on to coach there, like, forever.
Yep.
So, I'd like to say thank you guys for putting up with this long but truly wild story. And that is the story of the 1993 Houston Oilers.
I think that's why they're cursed to this day.
Yep. So
probably why they moved to Tennessee.
Actually, they moved because the owner wanted his second new stadium in 10 years. And Houston was like, suck it. So, all right, Ryan, take us home, baby.
All right. So let's talk about probably one of the greatest undrafted players of all time. Let's talk about local shit talker in the 1990s, John Randall. All right.
We already showed him to Shane, and Shane was like, "This dude, I can see why this dude's face paint gave you trauma as a kid growing up."
Oh yeah, he was famous. They got really into face painting and like doing stuff to intimidate the offense.
Yeah.
Sorry, he was a defensive lineman, if you don't already know that.
Our listeners are loyal. They know every single person we've ever covered and how they all relate to each other.
It's true.
The
subreddit's blowing up.
Yep.
they use a lot of tactics, the Minnesota 90s defensive linemen, including face painting, like a lot of shit talking. He was actually really small growing up. Going into college, he was like 6'1", 240. And that's pretty small for a defensive lineman to coming from nowhere to kind of take credible as like, oh, you're going to be really good draft stock, whatever. He grew up in Texas with his brother who also played in the NFL. This is what kind of helped him get onto the Minnesota Vikings. Like I said, he was undrafted, but fortunately at the time his brother was playing for the Tampa Bay Bucks. Tried out for that team, but he was thought to be too small, so they didn't sign him to a contract. But as luck would have it, a recommendation from the Minnesota Vikings head scout, Don Deich, Randall was told he could be picked up, but only if he could get his weight to 250 pounds. So this is a famous story where he had told one of his friends that the coach told him he's got to, you know, I think it was 244, so he had to gain like 6 pounds in like, I don't know, a couple days. So he famously went into weigh-in with a giant chain in his jock strap that weighed like 7 pounds, and he weighed in at 251, and the coach was like, all right, we'll give you a contract.
My man.
Right? So he played his first season with the Vikings in 1990. He quickly became one of the dominant defensive tackles of that era. He increased his training regimen and eventually like got to like, I don't know, 270, 280. So he realized he needed to get bigger, but that only helps his career in the long run. On his career, he had 137.5 sacks. All right. Now that's a lot of sacks to talk about to begin with. Right.
Yeah.
But traditionally sacks generally come on second and third down, you know, in passing situations and stuff like that.
Obvious passing situations. Yeah.
Right. Randall was such an aggressive defensive player and like his shit talking fucked with the line so much that he had more than a third of his sacks on first down. He had 53 sacks on first down.
That's so sick.
Monster.
Yeah. That is ridiculous. All right. During his, like I said, he played with the Vikings, so he obviously developed some rivalries with quarterbacks in that league, and the famous one is his rivalry with Brett Favre. He has a famous commercial. I don't even think it was like for KFC or anything like that, but it was a commercial where it starts off where he's like knitting a Brett Favre, like really tiny, like jersey.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, and then he like puts it on a chicken and lets the chicken go run around the yard, and he catches it, and then they show him barbecuing the chicken later because their rivalry was so crazy. It was a fun commercial to watch. One of his famous quotes, he was playing like the 49ers, I think in like 1995 was when I was looking at some of these sound bites. One of his famous quotes, he's just, okay, so they're like coming out after the punt or like kickoff return, right? And they're getting ready to set up, you know, for the first drive or whatever. And he's just yelling at the San Francisco offense. He's like, Red Rover, Red Rover, let those motherfuckers come on over.
I love 90s shit talk. So yeah. Good.
He also famously played for the Seahawks where I think he had like 115 tackles with the Vikings, something like that, and then got like another 20 or so with the Seahawks towards the end of his career. Like I said, 130 sacks. Great. He only ever had one interception, and he actually tied or no, the one of the Vikings record he has is the most consecutive seasons leading the team in sacks. That was from 1993 to 2000. Every year he led that team in sacks.
He was okay. So like, you know, when we talk about guys from the past, I always like to think about like, would they be successful in the modern NFL? John Randall would be a top five sack guy in 2023 if he was playing right now.
Yeah.
Like the way that he won with speed around the edge is how edge rushers go today.
Right. And I think a lot of the shit talking and just his aggressiveness with the game, he had to be like that because he was a smaller guy for a defensive lineman. He had to do everything he could to just do what he loved to do.
Right.
He's famous. He's also famously quoted as saying that he likes football better than sex. So you can see why he really tried to do very well on the field. There's a whole bunch of other quotes, and maybe Tony can work some into the audio.
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. Editing
later. But yeah, that's all time NFL Hall of Famer, John Randall,
one of the best
Minnesota Vikings.
One of the best undrafted players in NFL history, right?
It has to be, yeah.
He's up there. All right, that was great. So our 93s are done. We've taken, this has been a real wild bunch. Yeah, so let's take a quick break, and then I'll come back, hit you with the Vikings, and then we'll do Carolina and Jacksonville.
Yes, sir.
And commercial.
Man, you should hang out. We should go fishing together. I'll kick your old fellas.
Come kick me, man.
Be a man, my mo. Catch a feller by his toe. At the holler, let it go.
Let's go, come on. Come on, go.
We're coming now, buddy. We on our horses. Regulators, mount up. We're coming.
You're weak, man. Come on.
Hey, Stevie. I'm waiting on you, Stevie. I can smell you, Stevie.
Hey, bar scored 7 years ago, brother. Long time, brother. Come on, Steve, y'all. Bring it out, damn day.
You like that? You like that?
Skull, it's time. It's Vikings time. It's Vikings time.
Yeah, you better get some air horns in on that John Randall shit we just saw.
Oh, dude, John Randall. If there's ever been someone that called for air horns, it's John Randall. So we're going from John Randall to the Minnesota Vikings, the 2023 Minnesota Vikings. So we're going to start with Kirk Cousins here, who I believe is the most boring yet stable fantasy asset at quarterback in the game right now.
Dude, he's the CeeDee Lamb of quarterbacks.
Right. Well, so,
and he's got Justin Jefferson to throw to.
That's right. Cousins had 9 weeks of quarterback one play, which was actually less than I thought it would be when you consider about like how often Minnesota passes. They were the third highest rate pass rate in the league last year. Wow. So Kevin O'Connell was in year two. He was taken from the Super Bowl winning Rams. And now remember, that Super Bowl team was in year two of his offensive scheme. So past performance could indicate that if everything goes right, Minnesota's offense could take another jump this year. If you think about it, the similarities are uncanny. You've got the aging but immobile quarterback, you've got the superstar wide receiver, and you've got the tight end that has quarterback chemistry. It's all there. In fact, even the deficiencies are similar. The offensive line is weak at both offensive guard spots when it comes to protecting the passer. Now, Minnesota, like the 2021 Rams, have studs at both tackle positions and bad interior blocking for passing. So, like, I even broke it down by, like, PFF pass block grade for the 2021 Rams and the 2022 Vikings, and they're, like, about the same. Basically, this coach is, like, If we have two good tackles, I don't give a fuck what happens in the middle.
You got 2.5 seconds. Go. Sure.
Right. Even though the line is still ranked fairly high across all three of the places that I got data from. So they were all like, one was 11, one was 15, one was 9. So it's a little bit above average. O'Connell knows, like you guys said, that this scheme isn't dependent on the interior running game. So he's just got replacement level guys on the inside because it's a quick release West Coast offense that gets the ball to playmakers in space quickly. If Cousins gets time to throw, he's great because he had the third most catchable deep balls in the league last season with also the best deep ball accuracy in the league. It helps with Justin Jefferson, right?
Like that pass that was caught last year?
That Buffalo one?
Yeah, that shit was nuts.
I don't think there's another receiver in the NFL that makes that catch.
No.
When he gets time to stretch the defense, good things happen. He just needs to beat man coverage when blitzed. Because last year he was top 10 in EPA when not facing a blitz and bottom 10 when blitzed. If the offense jumps forward, it's going to be on the back of Kirk. Even though last year, low-key, Kirk had his worst year in Minnesota. He was worse in his career as a Viking in completion percentage, touchdown percentage, and yards per attempt. I wonder if that's like new system or if he's falling off. You know what I mean?
It's probably a new system because what did they go, like 13-4?
Yeah, they were right? Nuts. Yeah.
To get bounced the first round, but that's defensive, not offensive problem.
Right. So he threw the second most passes in the red zone last year, fourth in passing yards, fifth in touchdowns, second most catchable red zone throws. And instead of drafting a cornerback in the first round, they went and got Jordan Addison because this offense is ready to fuck. Right?
We're going 140.
Oh, man. All right. Cousins has been at the very end of quarterback one ranks at the end of the season for his last 3 years. And if there's a year for him to take his Rams Matt Stafford next level final leap, it's 2023. I don't think he's going to throw a ton downfield, but I think he's going to load up in the short and intermediate zones and deliver a ton of volume. And when he does go deep, numbers indicate that it'll be good. Not even the 2021 Rams passed as often as the 2022 Vikings. I think the reason why they passed so much, you guys, is because they were playing almost exclusively from behind in the fourth quarter last year.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Like you said, Shane, they went 13-4, but across all 17 games, the point differential, they were negative 87 points going into the fourth quarter.
Jesus Christ.
And yeah,
they had a lot of crazy comebacks. It was fun football to watch for sure.
Right. So the good thing for us in terms of fantasy is it looks like Minnesota's offense has three things going for it. They've got stud playmakers. They've got a scheme that prioritizes talent. And they got a defense that can't stop shit.
It wouldn't surprise me if this season ended up mirroring last season as well.
They kind of have to because, like, they got rid of Dalvin Cook. I know Tony will go into that, but it's like when your best running back as of right now is Alexander Mattison, you kind of have to throw the ball a lot.
Right. So
I don't think that's necessarily, like, I mean, when Cook's out, Mattison looks great.
We'll talk about it. I got some thoughts.
Okay.
So I just want to say, though, they were losing in the fourth quarter a ton, but even in neutral game script, the Vikings, fourth in the league in how much they passed when they were, like, in, you know, close. Sure. So I think they're just going to be hucking shit constantly. Kirk Cousins is going to get you 275 and two touchdowns every week no matter what, right?
Yeah, that's a good, solid average line for fantasy, yeah.
His lack of running means that he needs, like, a Hercules passing game to be, like, quarterback three on the week. But if you want a guy that's going to end up between quarterback 5 and 12 pretty consistently, I think Kirk's the move. So let me ask you guys, quarterback 12 on 4-for-4 when I did this, I'm sure he's moved up by now, but would you take Kirk Cousins or Tua?
Ooh, I'm going to go Cousins just because you said, you know, their defense is going to be like a sieve. They're going to have to throw a lot.
Sure.
In a vacuum, I think I take Tua because I think Tyreek plus Waddle is a better receiving room. But the fact that Tua is one sack away from his brain being turned into soup, I think I go Captain Coles.
Okay. Kirk Cousins or Jared Goff?
Fuck. I knew this was going to be it.
This is the one.
I'm all in on Detroit this year. I'm going Goff.
Yeah, I think we're going to see Sam LaPorta break. That offense is so much better to me than Minnesota's offense, where okay. I think that's where I lean.
So then last one, Kirk Cousins or Danny Dimes?
Ooh. Dimes has got that rushing upside, but I'm still gonna go Cousins on this one.
Okay.
I'm gonna go rushing upside.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, so let's move on. So I was low on the Vikings run game when we went into this. And I was low on the Vikings run game going into last year because I recognized so much of what made Dalvin Cook an asset last year or 2 years ago and beyond was the absurd level of volume that backs get in a Mike Zimmer offense, right?
Sure.
So I thought, well, maybe Cook will be good because they're going to spread the ball out a little bit more. They won't be running two tight ends. They'll be running three wide receivers, and they'll get lighter defensive boxes. And actually, that happened. They faced a light defensive box at the fifth highest rate and then were 25th in expected points added on rushing plays. So, yikes. They were also 29th in yards before contact, even though they were facing advantageous rushing situations. Mm. So I think the reason why people are drafting Madison so high is because they're remembering what he did when Cook was hurt in a Mike Zimmer offense. They were a bell cow rushing attack, and O'Connell just wasn't a bell cow rusher. Like, Cook had 265 rushes last year compared to Madison's 74. So Madison's never had more than 135 carries in a season. So I worry about, you know, how much he can get. I will say Madison had 19 rushes in the red zone. So 19 of his 74. So O'Connell likes Madison near the end zone, but is he going to be there to be, you know, more than just a touchdown dependent RB2? That's my question. So I took all the backs because I'm a degenerate. I took all the running backs that this guy, Kevin O'Connell, has called an offense for, and I broke down how many rushes and targets they all got. So averaged out, for all these years, 362 running back rushes and 70 targets for the running back room. So the question is, how do you split up that average? Well, Dwayne McBride, the seventh round rookie, had 5 combined catches in his 3-year college career. So I don't think he's going to be catching passes. He was a great runner in college, so I wouldn't be surprised if you see him mix in a little bit on first and second down. But I don't think Madison is like the move in this offense. I think he was great in the previous offense. He's out of 74 running backs with 100 or more rushing attempts in the last 2 years. Madison, 68th in yards per carry, 43rd in explosive run rate, and 42 in yards after contact per carry. I see that, and then I see Ty Chandler and Dwayne McBride, both brought in by the current regime, and I think all of them will see the field. Chandler had the best pass blocking grade on the roster at running back, so I think he'll be the third down guy if you're into that sort of thing. Okay. Madison's going to catch passes, but I don't think he has the profile to be the team's primary receiving back. Give me the guys that were drafted by this coaching staff and this management team that runs a 4.38 40-yard dash and pass blocks. I'm starting to fall in love with Ty Chandler as the third down back in Minnesota. But as of right now, as I say this, I fear the committee is fully here in Minnesota.
It's got to be.
I mean, we've seen this week, last 2 weeks, they don't give a shit about running backs anymore. Just burn them all. Who cares?
Yep. Wait, do they still have CJ Ham?
You know they do, bro.
Oh, hell yeah. There's going to be some Ham touchdowns this year.
I wouldn't be surprised. So I think we can give Madison anywhere between 55 to 65% of the early down work and then about 50% of the third down work and split the rest between Chandler and McBride. I think it might be worth taking shots on some of the rotation guys in late rounds.
They're probably free.
They are. And remember, Dalvin Cook had the most red zone snaps in the NFL at 147 last year. So there's value on the table if you can hit.
Sure.
And what did he finish as? Like RB like 20?
He was not good. So let me ask you guys about Alexander Mattison. Would you take Madison or Cam Akers?
Oh.
Yep. That's Madison where we're at.
Or Akers. Wow.
That's where we're at as a society right now.
I'm just going to go with the better offense. And I'm just going to say, yeah, I'm just going to say Madison. Yeah.
He's just going to fall into the end zone and get me Jamal Williams numbers.
Okay.
I think, I think that's it.
Madison or Damian Pierce?
Ooh, I like Pierce.
Yeah.
All right, last but not least, Alexander Mattison or David Montgomery?
Ooh. It sucks because, like, your either-ors are pretty much mirror mine, so now I got to go back and write some new stuff down.
All right, well, hey, you can abstain from this one. Abstain from this one.
Okay.
I'm going Monty.
Okay. All right, let's move on. Last year, Captain Coles himself, Kirk Cousins, was the most accurate quarterback in the NFL against zone coverage. And so I'm going to back this up a little bit, so try to follow me here. I'm a big Brett Coleman fan, and he had this video called The Tampa 2 is a Lie. So he explains a defensive alignment that's called 3-Buzz Mabel. All right?
All right.
3-Buzz Mabel is like a play that all defenses play, and they play it a lot. So think about, look at the field in your mind. The receiver on the weak side of the field is usually one-on-one. He's the only guy on that side of the field. All right? That receiver will get essentially a man-to-man coverage look. It's technically cover three, but it's like your best CB is usually over there, and he's expected to neutralize that one wide receiver on their own.
Is it the island? Is that what that's called?
Correct. So there's potential for safety help over the top if needed. Now, the strong side that has the tight end, the other wide receiver, and the slot receiver gets like a hybrid zone coverage. All right? Okay. So you've got essentially man on one side, zone on the other. And this is my way, when you sync this up with how Kirk looks at the field and what he's good at, this is my way of screaming at you to overvalue the wide receivers and tight ends that play on the strong side for Minnesota. So Jefferson, Hockenson, Addison will be schemed to face zone coverage as much as humanly possible. And this hides one of Kirk's biggest weaknesses, which is throwing into man coverage while blitzed. You guys remember when we did the Giants? Remember Wink Martindale?
Mm-hmm.
The
mm-hmm.
defensive coordinator that calls a ton of blitzes?
Yeah.
Is it any reason, are you surprised that a guy that's bad against blitzes would lose to a Wink Martindale defense twice?
No.
Right. So as we've looked at this theoretically, so let's look at it in terms of the players. I don't think Justin Jefferson needs a recap or a projection at all.
101 or 102, whatever you want to do. Who gives a shit?
he is the best player in football, I would argue. He should go 101. Like you said, over anybody. I don't care. I think there's a chance he's the next wide receiver triple crown winner, and there's a chance that this is his Cooper Kupp year where he is a legit contender for league MVP.
Okay.
Let's
see it, bro. I'm tired of these fucking quarterbacks.
If I told you that he was going to catch 130 passes for 1,900 yards and 12 touchdowns, would you say I disagree with that?
No.
Exactly.
It's probably lower.
He was double teamed on over 20% of his routes last year.
Wow.
Didn't matter. Didn't fucking matter. The rate that he was doubled was the second highest rate of double teams in reception perception's history, only behind 2021 Devontae Adams.
Really?
I think you have to have your coach go out there and swing on him to stop him on the gridiron.
Get Buddy Ryan out there. While we're on the stuff I learned from reception perception, his percent of drop passes was 2.1%. That's like obscenely good.
It's like one dropped pass.
Uh-huh. And he won 70% of his contested catches.
Which is weird to me because you don't really think of him as like a contested catch guy, right? You think Correct. Of him more as like a route runner, like catching in a bubble or whatever. But like, no, dude, he's a dog.
So let me ask you guys, is there a single fantasy player that you would rather have on your team more than Justin Jefferson this year? Instead of comparing two players, Justin Jefferson or the field?
Maybe Chase.
Okay.
I got to plant my flag, dude. AJ Brown.
That's the hot
shit.
I need some Neosporin for this, the heat that that take gives to
me. I got to stay true to myself and the claim that I made on the Eagles.
Okay. So let's move on. Let's do Jordan Addison. He's a dude that comes in with a crazy pedigree. There's no reason to expect he doesn't immediately step in and take over the Adam Thielen role, which was about 100 targets last year, 15 of which were end zone throws. Last year, the top two players in end zone targets were Justin Jefferson and Adam Thielen. Just fun fact there.
Nice.
R.I.P. Hawkinson.
Yep. So Addison's strength is in his versatility since he can line up both inside and out, make plays at all three levels. He's a terror on the deep ball, which is good with Cousins' accuracy. One of the things I talked about during the rookie guide was how half of Jordan Addison's catches his last season at USC were on screens, wide receiver screens. Right. Well, 52 of Adam Thielen's targets last year came behind the line or in the first couple yards. So he's going to get to do it again. He's also going to be running against defensive backfields that are worried about Justin Jefferson and TJ Hawkinson.
Yeah, so who do you cover?
You don't. You really don't.
I think that's like the weird thing for me for like defensive setups. It's like you can't stack the box, right? But like you have to blitz your D lineman every play and just play like cover four, right? Just put everybody in the secondary and just do that.
I love Addison because I feel like he's going to be lining up against the nickel or the second best cornerback on any given team. So I'm not going to go crazy and suggest he's just going to walk into 100 targets this year. Like, I think there's a good chance he will, but I can't just say that like I know it's facts, right? I'm not fucking stupid. I would say 80 is reasonable.
Yeah, I was going to say 70 conservative.
Yeah. I said in the draft guide that he's got the potential to be in the discussion with T. Higgins, Jalen Waddle, and Devonta Smith as the best wide receiver two in football. And so I want to grab Jordan Addison in as many dynasty or keeper leagues as I can. If he's not a solid fantasy producer this year, I think that would be a major disappointment given his capital scheme and supporting cast. So Jordan Addison, wide receiver 35 on 4-for-4. Jordan Addison or Mike Evans?
Addison.
Yeah, I'm not trusting anything to do with Tampa Bay this year.
No.
Okay. Jordan Addison or Michael Pittman?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Well, if Shane's right about Richardson, I'm going Pittman.
I think it's tough because my initial thing was I want the pocket passer who can throw the ball, right? Where we don't know what Richardson can do on the field, right? Mm-hmm. Like where your projection was year one, Jalen Hurts. But like mobile quarterbacks and mobile rookie quarterbacks tend to focus in on one guy in an RPO system, which is what he's going to do there. So it's going to be target lock for Pittman. It just depends what the quality of target is going to be. So it's going to be 110 targets to Pittman, but is he going to catch 75% of those compared to like the 80 targets that Addison gets?
Right.
So it's a ceiling versus floor thing. And I think Addison is the much cheaper play with the similar outcome in regards to like finishing within 3 points per game. So I think I lean Addison.
Okay. Last but not least, Jordan Addison or DJ Moore?
Ooh. Bring on the Bears.
Okay.
DJ Moore.
Okay.
Yep. Give me that top 15, potentially top 10 ceiling.
Okay. All right. Let's wrap it up here with TJ Hawkinson. His trade in week 8 was a huge game breaker as he went from an offense that only sporadically featured the tight end to a team that actually, this might blow you away, schemed plays for him. His lowest target count as a Viking was 6.
Holy shit.
Yeah, in most games, he was between 9 to 13 targets.
God damn.
And that's, I'm going to be real with you guys, that's Travis Kelce level volume.
Yeah.
And third in air yards, third in red zone targets, fourth in yards after the catch. And I honestly, I know some people are starting to like fall off a little bit on TJ Hawkinson, but I really don't think any of this changes, even with Addison in the mix.
Yeah, because we're just moving laterally from Addison or from Thielen to Addison. Like the target share is going to be the same.
Correct. I feel like when we first started this process and I was doing best ball drafts to try to, you know, use my research advantage to be competitive, I was seeing Hockenson as tight end 2, but now it's Andrews and Hockenson is tight end 3.
Well, everybody falls in love with Andrews again, right? Once like the Lamar situation got situated and everyone's like, oh yeah, he's just really good and he's the number one receiving option on that team.
Correct. So even in Detroit, his yearly finish was about tight end 7, and that's with scheme working against him. He was tight end 4 in fantasy points per game last year, and if the offense continues this pass rate, those numbers are going to keep going up. He'll be the main target in Kirk's most effective distance and direction, which is the short middle. And, I mean, I'm going to tell you, hey, guess what? Guess what's going to happen this week, you guys? Sun's going to shine. Moon's going to moon. TJ Hockenson's going to go 8 for 74.
Sure.
In leagues where I don't get Kelsey, I'm perfectly fine with taking Hockenson. I think his floor is going to be around TE4 between Kelsey, possibly Andrews, and then whatever tight end booms in a given week.
Yeah, Pitts or, yeah.
Yeah, somewhere. Or even like a Cole Kmet 2-touchdown game, you know? Like, You'll get those weeks where he gets 16 targets and puts up 35 PPR points. Like, that's just a thing.
Yeah.
So I am going to wrap just by saying I'm all in on this entire offense outside of the running back room. I have 2 questions, but it's really only 1 question. The first one that doesn't really count is TJ Hockenson or George Kittle?
Where does Hawk go? 4th round?
Yeah, that's about where I've seen him.
And then Kittle's like 5 or 6?
Yeah.
Yeah, I still think I go Hawk because based on my Niners episode, I still think that even though Kittle was a target of Purdy, I think he's the fade in that offense for me this year.
Okay. Finally, let's just end it here. TJ Hockenson or Mark Andrews?
Ooh. Damn. I like Andrews too much.
Okay.
I'm going Hawk, dude. Like, I think the new scheme, even though Andrews is going to be the primary target, I think it's going to take a little bit of acclimating time, as well as the ball being spread around, where we've never really seen Lamar with more than 1 or 2 receiving options in his room, so I don't know how the target share is going to shake out.
Sure.
Where we know what Hockenson can do, right? Like you said, or I said, we're moving from Thielen to whatever, laterally.
I've been doing research for 3.5 months now. I've written extensively on both of these players, and my informed opinion is flip a coin.
Very fair.
That's all it is. So all in on Minnesota's offense. They will be throwing the ball a whole lot, and you'll do well to grab a couple pieces if you can. So that's the Vikings, and that's part 1 of episode 93. Any last thoughts before we go into the deliberation chamber and come out with some more takes?
Skull. So. Okay. Who wins the NFC North?
Detroit.
It's defense. It's going to kill them.
I think. Like, I don't think that, I think that Minnesota's success requires more things to go perfectly right than Detroit's.
Yeah, and think about how many of those games they'll potentially get into this year that are just like last year, except they'll lose this time instead of win those games.
Yeah, I hate to say it because Lions fans be getting real obnoxious. But
yeah, did you hear earlier today? It was like the first time in forever that Detroit Lions sold out their entire full season ticket holders.
Holy shit, dude.
Yeah, for them. They did it. And let's hope now this year JFK will miss his second Lions playoff victory. Because he's only missed one. All right. So we will see you back here for the next episode where we cover the Panthers and
the Jacksonville Jaguars.
And talk to you soon. Goodbye.
Regular!